This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Harrison and Noel Lim. It is 6 a.m. Wednesday, the 12th of August. And, you know, the week really does fly. We're already, you know, at the midpoint of our work week. And I feel like, it's the weekends, it feels like the weekend's just finished and now it's on its way back.
Yes. Wonderful, isn't it?
Yes, indeed it does. It is midweek. It is midweek, what some of us like to refer as peak day. It's the middle of the week. It's where you're supposed to be at your peak status. At least I like to think that we are at our peak status in the middle of the week, but who knows?
I would like to think that we're at peak status, you know, throughout the week and throughout the rest of our lives.
Because... Yes, I'm not sure about 6 a.m. Yeah, maybe I tend to peak a bit later, like 7 a.m.
Well, we all try our best, right?
So what is the peak hour on the peak day?
I think it varies depending on the individual, right? For some people, it's afternoon.
We need to conduct a thorough scientific investigation into this matter, and so that we can increase productivity.
Yes, because that's what we are indeed going to be talking about later on in this hour. But first, if we take a look at after the 6:30 news, Noel, what do we have then?
Well, a slew of news for sure. Kamala Harris, big news there. And Russia, first to register coronavirus vaccine. And something about Trump, of course.
Something about Trump. That seems to be the headline. Like, we could just use that every
day. There will always be something on him.
And it will fly, you know?
Have you seen his Facebook post last night?
No, I did not see his Facebook post last night. I tried to keep some form of sanity in my life.
That's a good idea.
But it is, I used to follow his Twitter handle. It was a stressful endeavor to do so. But, you know, we've also got some other things we're covering. You know, towards the end of the hour, we will take a look at the local paper, see what's happening there and the front pages. But in about 10 minutes, right after we talk about productivity, we're going to be talking about rewards and punishments, really. Are punishments a way of helping behavior? So that's something we'll be exploring.
All right. And remember, if you want to weigh in on the conversation with us, you can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, though, of course, we are going to be talking about the dark side of productivity. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. You're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. That was Boogie Wonderland with Earth, Wind and Fire. Quite a nice way to start a morning, I have to say.
It's the greatest way to start the day.
Especially those first couple of chords, you know.
It makes you want to boogie.
It pulls you into Boogie Wonderland. And is there ever a better place to be than Boogie Wonderland?
At 6 a.m.
I mean, at 6 a.m., you know, you really do need the Boogie Wonderland to get you started, right?
That's true.
But some people, you know, I guess for some people, just the act of doing and the act of achieving and accomplishing things can be motivation enough for them to start their work day, for them to take on more projects. Because we're talking about productivity this morning, and productivity is one of those buzzwords that comes with positive connotations. You know, we're not completely innocent of it. We talk about, you know, ways to maximize our productivity here at 6 o'clock in the morning on The Morning Run. But sometimes there is also a dark side to it, right? When productivity is taken to an extreme. You know, we talk about workaholics as well sometimes. And these are the people who, you know, work 70-hour work weeks. And for them, productivity can actually be an addiction.
Well, then we went from Boogie Wonderland and the excitement from that to talking about the dark side of productivity.
I know, the mood just kind of went from way up here to like way down there.
Yeah, but, you know, it's a really important thing to discuss, right? Because, yes, we do talk a lot about productivity and ways to... at least from our own experiences, how to, you know, work better and all of that. And also just that work-life balance situation. But like anything, especially if you gamify it, these things can become an addiction. And speaking from a former productivity addict, it can be a very slippery slope because then you start judging your entire life based on the habits you're tracking. And yes, I did track my habits. I still do, but I used to track everything at one point. My calendar used to be filled with, it still is, but not as bad. It used to be filled with everything I used to do in the day. And I used to quantify, I tried my very best to quantify every part of my life, from the work to the social, to the habits I did, to the exercise I was doing, the calories I was burning, all of that. And it really kind of gets you in, it absorbs you and takes you into a spiral. So productivity is good, but like anything, too much of it is a really terrible trapping thing.
Yeah, so I was going to say that I could write a book about addiction to work, but I'm not sure now. Maybe you should write the book. Or we could co-author that book. So I am quite addicted.
Let's co-author it. No,
I was quite addicted to work. You know, I just work, right? Because, you know, there's a sense of accomplishment. And now that this does make me take stock, addiction, yeah. So it could be addicted to that buzz, right? And, you know, it can affect relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're constantly working, right? And your focus is on work, and it may affect the people around you, family, not just your partner. And also, it can take a toll on your mental health. Initially, it didn't feel that way. You know, you're just going. And also, but then you come to a certain age, it starts to affect your physical health. And I think when I stopped was when the body yells at me and says, stop. Just stop.
Yeah, I think sometimes you just have to, you kind of have to pay attention to what's happening, you know, outside of you, inside of you. But I guess the question is, how do you break from that kind of addictive cycle of productivity, right? Because for a lot of people, it becomes so habitual, like, you know, Roshan tracking every step of his day, you know, from dawn until dusk and beyond.
And my sleep too.
And your sleep too.
So you wake up that half hour and you write that down.
Did you track your dreams too?
No, I didn't track my dreams, but I had a sleep tracker and all of these different trackers. Mm. The habit app I used, actually, I still use, it's called Strides.
I think you definitely should write that book.
It is it's actually a really good app. And I think if you used it in effective manners, in tracking those really high-level habits that really make or break your day, I think that's where the power of productivity can come from. But when you start tracking things like, I don't know, the number of glasses of water you drink in a day and stressing about all these things, it can get really tough.
Oh, that depends if you have a health situation, and then mm-hmm. you may have mm-hmm. to track your diet and the amount of water that you drink more religiously.
Yeah, but Roshan, you know, you said that you don't do it anymore now as well. So Noelle explained that for her, the tipping point was when it started to affect her physical health. What was the tipping point for you that made you kind of step back from that high level of productivity tracking?
The degree of control all these habits had in my life, right? Because now all my decisions were being channeled through these habits. If I wanted to, whatever it was, I had to make sure these habits were done. And I really, it was my value system started moving away from a outcome-based system to a process-driven system. Now, there's nothing wrong with a process-driven system, but it's very short-termism, right? It's the same thing how we criticize public sector companies for being quarter-driven as opposed to long-term vision-driven. There is a balance in between. You have to be concerned about the short-term results, but without forgetting the long-term. And I was starting to dilute the long-term goals and aspirations. So yes, I've done a lot of thinking about this, plenty of journal entries about this as well.
Yeah, so I think the key word is balance, having that balanced approach, making some time or making some allowance for any changes, right? Or something that you didn't expect and not to get upset about it. There's also another thing about, you know, productivity. There's that fear of wasting time. And that could result in you not wanting to delay gratification like you want it now. And that can be quite damaging even to your career, right? Or even to your relationship, because you need something now and that person may not be available to you, for you.
Yeah, actually that fear of wasting time was actually really this thing, because I wanted to optimize every minute in my day. Now I realize that it's okay to waste some time in the day because, you know, you're not meant to be on 24 hours or at least 16 hours a day.
And that wasting time, so-called wasting time, can make you feel more resourced.
Yeah, and sometimes you just need to, you need that wind down in order to really hit your maximum level of productivity the next time you actually really need to. But do let us know what you think and how you balance productivity. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have some messages coming up and then we're going to be talking about punishment and whether or not it deters crime. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Queen with Princes of the Universe. And you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noelle. So I realise that we've got a bit of a heavy morning this morning because the next topic that we have on our agenda is talking about punishment, particularly in the criminal justice system. So there's an article in... it's from the University of Helsinki, but it's talking about whether or not harsh punishments deter crime. And this is really the perennial question whenever we look at the punitive systems that we have in place in order to, in a lot of cases, you know, the aim seems to be to remove unsavory elements, and I say this in air quotes, from the society at large. But considering that recidivism rates, you know, around the world tend to be rather high, the question is always whether or not a punitive approach or a rehabilitative approach is the better one to take. And I think the Norway model is a good example of the rehabilitation approach, right? So they have a prison capacity of maybe 4,500 inmates, and they actually have empty prisons, which is a situation that is not really faced anywhere else in the world.
Yes, that's the same also for the Netherlands. I think they even have to rent out spaces to other countries, so which is quite strange. And then they have to convert some of these spaces into like hospitals or, you know, shopping centres. That would be quite fun. Anyway, I think what comes to mind is things like capital punishment mm-hmm. and corporal punishment. Like capital punishment, I think I feel quite personally about this. Simply, I mean, who are we to play God, right? To say, okay, because you did this, you deserve to die. So I think there's always that moral question there. And does it really deter people from, for example, in the case of Malaysia, does it deter people from carrying drugs, from distributing drugs? It still does not, right?
Yeah, but I guess when it comes to harsher punishments, there's also a scale to it, right? Because harsh punishment is relative to the crime or the alleged crime. So things like, let's take, for example, the COVID-19 situation and the wearing of masks, right? Mm-hmm. So that's something that's very relatable today, right now. So now I think if you don't wear a mask, you'll find 1,000 ringgit. Is that harsh? Is that not harsh? Is that too much? I think earlier this week, we saw a video of someone who was really distraught by the fact that he was fined 1,000 ringgit. On the flip side, we have seen some politicians not wearing face masks in public, in open areas, and 1,000 ringgit doesn't mean as much to them. So it's very, very relative. And then it can be very harsh for the individual on the ground, but not as harsh for the other person who has a bit more money in their pocket.
And maybe a bit more protection.
Sure.
Having said that, you know, that 1,000 ringgit, it did strike the fear of God in me. So, and I wear the mask everywhere I go.
Yeah, so see, in that situation, it seems to have helped in a way, right? Because now it's fear. It's fear-based governing. But in a way, we tried the other way, right? That we tried the education system, and telling people, hey, listen, everyone needs to wear their mask, be responsible, da-da-da. And there were still many people, from my personal observation as well, who weren't exactly following the SOPs.
So, but for me, right, there always is an inflection point when you come to when you talk about scale of punishments in this case, right? So, we're talking about fines right now, and yes, for a certain for some segments of society, a 1,000 ringgit fine is going to be extremely hard, right? It could destroy a family's ability to put food on the table. But when we're talking about imprisonment as well, it's like as soon as you go into prison, you know, in a lot of cases, you spend a couple of years there. You come out, and that mark is on you forever, right? For a lot of other people, a fine, you know, and because the fines are also dependent on the judge and any mitigating circumstances and all of that, a fine just doesn't leave the same kind of black mark on your record that imprisonment does. And it's also a psychological issue, right? Because a lot of people who have spent time in prison, especially if you're a repeat offender, if you've gone in and out of various maybe juvenile detention facilities in your youth, there is the higher chance that you will be convicted for another crime as you get older, because a lot of our country's systems and our social systems aren't geared towards rehabilitating these prisoners once they come out and effectively become functioning members of society.
I think that's the key, right? It's whether, is this a system that is just meant to keep people away from society, or is it a rehabilitation system? Mm-hmm. And it's also the framing around it, right? When you talk about criminal policy, now you're immediately framing it as it's policy just for criminals instead of rehabilitation policy. So it's also the way you frame it and the idea of what it means to be in prison. Is it just, again, I think the key question from my view is it a place to keep certain members of quote unquote unsavory members of society away from the larger society, or is it a place to help rehabilitate?
Yeah, so speaking about what happens in prisons, I was watching this video, Norway, they mm-hmm. apparently have the most humane prisons, or at least from the perspective of the person who did the video. So prisoners there are not treated like normal, except they're just confined in an area. So it means they actually have their own rooms. I guess there's so many available rooms anyway. And it's like a dormitory. like a university dormitory, and they wear normal clothes. They have access to shoes, they have access to books, which I think is the same for most prisons anyway. And they get some emotional support and also, like, you know, efforts to help them reintegrate back to community. I think there's a lot of counseling there.
I think it's at the base of it, the understanding that even though these people have committed this crime, they are at the end of the day still people and still deserving of a certain level of human rights, right? And a certain level of freedoms. So, you know, if we bring it back to the Malaysian context as well, there is a cost element to this, because so this is coming off of statements made by the previous law minister, Liu Wee-kiong, who pointed out the fact that we have a capacity for about 45,000 inmates in Malaysia. At about early last year, I think the prison population stood at 66,000 to 70,000 prisoners. So we had an overcrowding situation. In some places, it was so severe that prisoners had to sleep in shifts in order to manage the lack of availability of simple things like beds. And, you know, how much does it cost to keep someone in prison? The average cost is about 40 ringgit a day. So if you multiply that, that's I think that the calculation came up to 2.4 million ringgit a day to maintain our prison population. So the idea at the time, I think, was to lower the number of convicts. There was some talk about decriminalizing certain drug offenses, but whether or not that's actually been implemented and whether or not we're still facing this problem, I think remains to be seen.
So when I hear that, right, I start thinking about the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? So it really, the ability to self-actualize, which is what the Norway system is doing. It comes from a point of quote-unquote, a developed nation, right? A first world nation that has kind of dealt with the physical needs and the security needs and has come to a point where it can think about, okay, how do we do things better in a more holistic manner? Whereas most prison systems are not really talked about, neglected, and even the base needs of those systems are not addressed. So the only purpose of those systems is, again, to separate certain people from society.
Yeah, so having said that, about this thing about developed markets, I think US, for example, their prison system's a mess. So I think it's all about culture, right? Culture of the nation, mm-hmm. looking at the Scandinavian model.
Yeah, and I think there's also an element of checking our own vengeful tendencies, perhaps, at the door. You know, this person, it's a very eye for an eye system that we still have in many of our detention systems. But let us know what you think. You know, is punishment an effective deterrent to crime? You can WhatsApp us 01878988999 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have the 6:30 News Bulletin coming up next. But first, Ain't No Sunshine by Bill Withers, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanison and Noel Lim. That was Every Morning by Sugar Ray. And now we are bringing you some international stories, the biggest one of which broke overnight, Joe Biden, so the Democratic presidential candidate, has named his running mate. So that is Senator Kamala Harris, the first Black woman and Asian American in the role. So Kamala Harris, of course, was at one point Joe Biden's rival for the post of presidential candidate. Since then, and she was long considered a front runner for the number two slot as well, considering that Biden said that he would be picking a woman. So the question was which woman and whether or not he would choose Kamala Harris as also a way to represent the minorities in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I think Mr. Biden was really faced with quite a tough choice because, you know, there's so many capable women leaders to choose from, right? And other names that come to mind, Tammy Duckworth, also very illustrious career in the military. And also, I think Val Demings, also from the police force in Florida. So Kamala Harris, I think some of the things that she stands for, she supports her healthcare reforms and also to recognize undocumented migrants as well as to support the DREAM Act. And I think she's also very keen to ban assault weapons. You know, I think always when you bring a woman on board, there's always a bit more compassion, more compassionate agenda, perhaps more inclusive.
I don't know. Barack Obama was pretty compassionate during that time, but it is definitely, it's a political decision, right? The VP pick is supposed to balance out the presidential nominee. So she's supposed to be, to bring up more liberals. She's supposed to, because Biden is seen maybe sometimes too centrist or maybe not opinionated enough. He's never really stood for anything. And the most I think one of the highest things that what he's most known for is being, well, former President Barack Obama's vice president, right? So yep. Where does he stand in amongst all this? And that has been the Democratic problem for so long, because whatever you want to say, people were supporting Trump because they believed that he would represent certain things. There was a strong belief around it. And I think it's very hard to galvanize support when you don't have a particular angle to support with.
Yeah, and the problem also is it has to do with the development of the Democratic Party, particularly over the last couple of years, right? We've seen, you know, the Democratic Party become increasingly fractured. So this was part of what a lot of people said led to the kind of distance between the supporters of Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton in the last presidential elections, and the battle for the nomination became so bitter that one of the reasons that people attribute to Hillary Clinton losing the eventual election is that she failed to convert the Sanders vote. So, you know, for Joe Biden, who in a lot of respects is similar to Hillary Clinton in terms of policy and in terms of his history, he needed someone to bring him that more liberal component of the Democratic Party.
It's also about whether you can excite the base, whether you can galvanize support, because elections are a pull factor for countries that aren't compulsory anyway. It's a pull factor. So you have to get people in to line up and vote for you. And in some constituencies, that's very difficult in the US because of a various multitude of factors that we can get into another day. But specifically here, it's about getting that pull attraction. It's pull marketing, really. And that's what the Sanders base had. That's what the Elizabeth Warren base had. AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, also has that pull factor. These are the exciting members of the Democratic Party that also represent the very the leftist side, the more radical, not radical, but the more progressive element of the Democrats.
Yeah,
I think now how they're pitching Biden is basically, all right, you already have an uncertain, unstable individual in Trump. Biden is stable. Is that enough of a pull, though?
Yeah, so I think it's a good combination. In a sense, Biden represents that, you know, that world order, right? You know,
The establishment.
Sort of a business as usual, but a bit more progressive. Plus, and he now has a VP who he describes as a fearless fighter for the little guy and one of the country's finest public servants. So I certainly wish her the best.
Absolutely. Now, of course, we are going to be watching this very closely in the run-up to the November elections. But if we take a look very quickly as well over at Russia, President Vladimir Putin has claimed that Russia has registered the world's first COVID vaccine. So he says that one of his daughters has already taken it. And as far as he knows, it was registered on Tuesday morning, the first time in the world. But of course, there are also questions over whether or not Russia actually truly ran through every phase of the safety trials that should have been run through. There have been some rumors that, you know, some of the phase 3 trials were contracted, shall we say. So I guess there is still a little bit of concern over the safety, ultimately, of the vaccine that Russia has said that they're going to put out. But right now we are heading into some messages, and then up next we're going to be taking a look at the front pages of our newspapers and local portals, so be sure to stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9. That was Englishman in New York by Sting, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Roshan and Noel. 6:50 a.m. Wednesday, the 12th of August, and we are bringing you the latest from the front pages of our newspapers and portals this morning. So I've got the Star in front of me, and their front page is a big splash of three charged. So along with pictures of former Finance Minister Lim Guan Eng, his wife Betty Chu, as well as Pang Li Kun, who he was charged with abetting Lim Guan Eng in gaining a certain amount of money, allegedly, for his wife, Betty Chu. So this is the third charge that the former chief minister is facing in, I think, about 5 days. He already claimed trial to a charge in Butterworth, as well as one charge in KL over the Penang Undersea Tunnel project. So we had a conversation about what these charges would mean for Pakatan Harapan with Dr. Bridget Welsh of the University of Nottingham's Asia Research Institute yesterday. If you want to listen in on that conversation, you can find it on the BFM app as well as on Spotify.
Yeah, so looking at New Straits Times, basically on the page one, their headlines are face mask ceiling price set at 1 ringgit. So you're not expected to pay more than 1 ringgit for that 3-ply face mask. That's the one that is, once you use it, you have to throw it away. And then I think the wholesale price would be set at 95 cents. But I think I hear that, you know, you can actually get them even cheaper at Lazada, but I'm not sure about the quality. Having said that, a consumer group did say that the proposed 1 ringgit per unit retail price may still be quite high, actually. And this is according to the Malaysian Muslim Consumer Association. I think they are rather concerned about people who are living, you know, the B40 community, whether they can afford that kind of price point. And also, I think the good news here is 9 new virus cases. We are down to single digits again. And the police have been very active. I think they nabbed 230 people for, you know, breaching the SOP.
Yeah, and I think this relates earlier to the punishment story we're talking about, but it's really around the concern around the following of the SOPs. I've got the Malaysian Reserve in front of me, and it's taking a look. It's a little bit of a preview towards what it's expecting to see for the second quarter GDP numbers, which are expected tomorrow from Bank Negara. If we take a look at the first quarter, Malaysia still saw growth of 0.7%. That's narrowly avoided contraction there. But the second quarter is... It also includes the MCO phase, which we arguably would see the biggest amount of disruption to the economy. So this is a number that we're going to have to pay attention to, because I think Singapore numbers came out yesterday as well, and they saw a contraction. So expectations of a double-digit contraction. And I think the other thing to pay attention to is, of course, that the loan moratorium is going to come to an end. I think it ends at the end of September. So after that, businesses will start to have to pay their loans again. People have started to pay their loans again. There is going to be a financial implication from that. So that's, I think, another date. October is a month that we're going to have to watch in terms of how the economy does then.
Now, I also have the Malay Mail open on my computer in front of me. And their lead story here is government backbenchers call for the withdrawal of the IPCMC bill. So I think this is a call that's been helmed by Dato' Sri Mohamed Nazri Aziz, who's Padang Rengas MP and former tourism minister as well, and backed by Dato' Sri Shahidan Kasim, who's the RO MP. So this has been on a couple of the portals saying that, you know, this is not something that was on the Perikatan National agenda. Even the police don't agree with it, so it should be taken off the docket. But I guess the question really is, if you look at the main thrust of the IPCMC bill, right, it is in favor of transparency. So I don't really understand the reason for the pushback. Nazri says that it's over concern that any committee overseeing it will be chaired by people with vested interests, but isn't that what Parliament's for, to be able to provide some kind of check and balance?
Yeah. Anyway, so on Malaysia Kini, some news here. More corporates, actually. Top Glove Corporation is working rapidly to resolve this month's issue that prompted a US customs import ban, and this will include improving its migrant workers' living conditions, according to the managing director. I certainly hope that, you know, the other rubber glove makers and also even manufacturers of Malaysia to look into this area, right? Because we know that some of these people do live in very crowded and cramped quarters. And also this other piece here by Malaysia Kini, political interference, the tycoon who got entangled in Najib's 1MDB scandal. So apparently property tycoon Lim Soon Ping, who is linked to TT Jaya Land, he's the founder, found himself in the centre of attention when de facto law minister Taqiyuddin Hassan claimed that the Tan Sri got political help with his frozen bank account linked to the 1MDB scandal.
Yeah, just going back to the GDP numbers there, although the Malaysian Reserve does say they expect the figures to be announced tomorrow, the Edge says that it's scheduled for Friday. So just something to keep in mind there.
Yes, a little bit of a discrepancy. But right now we have the 7 o'clock news bulletin coming up for you. And then, of course, we're going to be bringing you more business news and analysis. So be sure to stay tuned. But first, some music for you. Summer of 69 by Bryan Adams, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.